Hi, you're listening to Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition, where we bring you the latest trends in the oncology pharmacy space. I'm your host, Alex Gerlach, and this month we're going to be talking about colorectal cancer. We've been seeing rates of colorectal cancer rise in recent years, especially in younger generations. So I want to take this opportunity to spread a little bit of awareness about what colorectal cancer is, why we're seeing these rates rise, what the treatment landscape looks like, and of course, what is the role of pharmacists in treating patients with colorectal cancer. I'm joined by Megan May, a clinical oncology pharmacy specialist from Baptist Health, who shared her insight and her experience working with patients with colorectal cancer. So without further ado, let's get started. Hi, Megan, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for meeting with me this morning. And I just kind of want to talk about colorectal cancer because it's definitely becoming a big issue in people my age. We're seeing a lot of people being diagnosed, even with stage four colorectal cancer, who are in their, you know, mid to late 20s. So I think it's really important to discuss colorectal cancer, why we're seeing these rates increase, what is the treatment landscape. So we're going to start off pretty easy. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you found yourself in oncology pharmacy?
Yes. Thanks for having me here today. I'm excited to talk about colorectal cancer more with you. My name is Megan May. I'm a clinical oncology pharmacy specialist at Baptist Health Lexington in Lexington, Kentucky. We are a large community hospital, and I work primarily in the outpatient cancer center. How did I find myself in oncology pharmacy? Well, I always knew I wanted to be a specialist. And during my first year residency, I had an oncology rotation and truly just fell in love with this patient population. The patients are so caring and willing to listen to what we have to say and any education we can provide. Usually this is probably one of the worst times of their life when they get a cancer diagnosis, and oncology pharmacists can just make such an impact on these patients. So I really felt led to furthermore educate in oncology pharmacy and become a specialist with it.
Pretty broad, but what is colorectal cancer?
In general, colorectal cancer is defined as any cancer that occurs in the last two parts of the large intestine. So that could be the colon or the rectum. It is estimated that there were 152,000 new cases of colorectal cancer diagnosed in 2024, and colorectal cancer led to 53,000 deaths. Colorectal cancer, it is the fourth most common cancer currently in the United States.
Right. And so we're seeing cases of colorectal cancer, especially stage four, rising in younger generations. What do you believe is influencing this increase in colorectal cancer cases in young people?
Yeah, unfortunately, colorectal cancer is increasing in young adults, but it still is relatively rare. Colorectal cancer, it is the leading cause of cancer deaths in men under 50 and the second leading cause of death in women under 50. Colorectal cancer, the incidence in people under 50 has been increasing by about 2% per year since 1994. So we are definitely seeing it more than what we have in the past. Nobody knows for sure why colorectal cancer numbers are rising in young people. Some thoughts include the sedentary lifestyle, overweight and obesity, smoking, heavy alcohol use, low fiber, high fat diets, or diets high in processed meat. We do know some known risk factors though, family history of colorectal cancer or polyps, and patients who have conditions like inflammatory bowel disease. One thing I want to make sure the younger population is aware of is they need to know about the symptoms that can occur and make sure they act upon them. So sometimes I've seen younger patients might have rectal bleeding and they think nothing of it. So for example, I had a younger male patient and he had been bleeding into his stool for a few months, but he just associated it with past hemorrhoids that he had had. So he didn't do anything for about 6 months and then finally went to the doctor and got a diagnosis of colorectal cancer. So it's important to know at diagnosis of colorectal cancer, 85% of patients that are under age 50 actually have ongoing symptoms at that time. So
Wow.
some of the symptoms, to be aware of is constipation, rectal bleeding, or sudden changes in bowel movements.
So now that we've talked about the symptoms, we've talked about the people that get colorectal cancer, let's talk about how we treat colorectal cancer. What does the current landscape look like for these patients?
So, in general terms regarding treatment, surgical resection is considered the primary modality for resectable colorectal cancer. And standard therapies like chemotherapy, radiotherapy, immunotherapy, and targeted therapy, these are more utilized for non-resectable cases. So, if we discuss this in a little more detail, I'll lay it out for you. For early stage local disease, the main treatment is surgery. We also look at considerations from biomarkers in locally advanced setting. So we specifically look at MSS and MMR status. So that's microsatellite stability or instability. And then if patients are proficient or deficient in mismatch repair. So for patients with locally advanced but resectable colon cancer, if they are MSI high or MMR deficient, we can use neoadjuvant immunotherapy, but patients should still have surgery within 6 weeks after completing that neoadjuvant immunotherapy. When we move to more high-risk stage two and most stage three diseases, surgery and adjuvant chemotherapy is what is typically used. This continues for about 3 to 6 months. It depends on the specific regimen that you use on the length of time patients need adjuvant treatment. And the reason we use the adjuvant treatment in this setting is really aimed at eradicating the micrometastasis disease. So this could be disease that we don't necessarily see on scans, but it could still be in the body. And we're really trying to prevent reoccurrence because we know the risk of reoccurrence is the highest in the first to third year from diagnosis. So that's why we give adjuvant treatment in those stages. And then lastly, to talk about the metastatic setting or stage four, this is really where we're using most of the chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and/or targeted therapy. Depending on some patient-specific characteristics will help guide our treatment decisions. So specifically, we're looking at the patient's comorbidities, their performance status, their age, and of course, considering the patient's goal of care. We also are now evaluating biomarkers. So specifically, we're looking at RAS or RAF testing, the MSI status, HER2 status, and NTRK status. And then lastly, we consider if it's right or left-sided of the tumor. Traditionally, the right versus left-sided was really one of the main ways we gauge treatment. But now that we have these biomarkers, it's leading to more personalized treatment. So just to look at the right versus left. So if the colon cancer is on the right side, this is usually more mucinous, and usually we see BRAF or RAS mutations, and these patients usually are MSI high. So if you see right-sided colon cancer, this usually predicts a better response to our anti-VEGF therapy like bevacizumab. When you look at the left side, these patients usually have HER2 amplification and they're KRAS wild type. So left side usually predicts better response to our anti-EGFR therapy like panitumumab or cetuximab. Really, the backbone for treatment of metastatic colorectal cancer is the combination of chemotherapy. This consists mainly of fluoropyrimidines, so that's your IV fluorouracil or 5-FU, or our oral capecitabine. These are usually combined with oxaliplatin and/or irinotecan. It's important too that we add leucovorin to 5-FU depending on the patient and the specific regimen, because that leucovorin enhances the binding of 5-FU to prevent it from being immediately degraded. With stage four, we also have targeted therapy that is added to that chemotherapy backbone. So for our first line setting, We can use the anti-VEGF bevacizumab. If the patient is KRAS wild type, we use our EGFR inhibitors, panitumumab or cetuximab. We also evaluate BRAF V600E. And if that patient is mutated, we could use cetuximab and encorafenib now in combination with chemotherapy. In addition, we look at MMR status. So if a patient is MMR deficient or MSI high, we now can use immunotherapy, the combination with nivolumab and ipilimumab, or we can use monotherapy immunotherapy. So we've really had some wonderful advancements in metastatic setting lately. So that was the first line setting. We also have more biomarker-driven setting treatment for the second line setting. So depending if the patient does have that BRAF V600E, HER2 positivity, KRAS G12C mutation, NTRK, or RET gene fusions, we do have targeted therapy for these patients, which makes the treatment more personalized for them. And then lastly, in the third line setting, we do have options also. So we have regorafenib. You can use Lonsurf with or without bevacizumab, fruquintinib. And then we also always need to be thinking about best supportive care and if a patient is eligible for a clinical trial. So when looking overall at colorectal cancer treatment, it's really evolved over the last few years, and it gives patients a chance for more prolonged survival and better outcomes. So it's really just figuring out the sequence of how to give patients each of these medications over time.
And so, what are some emerging methods or agents that are gaining attention for you or, in the clinical space around treatment of colorectal cancer, might already kind of be in the treatment landscape or could be something that maybe is still in clinical trial investigations?
One thing I'm really excited about is how we are including more of the molecular testing in colorectal cancer. So we're really doing more next generation sequencing in this setting. The more comprehensive molecular profile we can get of colorectal tumors, this is really helping tailor treatment based on individual genetic mutations and molecular characteristics. So, usually that means less side effects. With more precision medicine, it can prevent patients from receiving, maybe chemotherapy that could be more toxic to them. So it's really exciting to see this setting focus more on that. Another topic that's really has some growing interest is looking at circulation tumor DNA or ctDNA. This is really highly specific cancer biomarker. One of the benefits of using ctDNA is the ability to be able to do a liquid biopsy on these patients, so not necessarily having to do a tissue biopsy. ctDNA, it really is emerging as a valuable tool for risk stratification, guiding adjuvant therapy decisions, and monitoring for MRD or minimal residual disease. Just recently, the NCCN guidelines, they now recognize the clinical utility of ctDNA in colorectal cancer. If the ctDNA is detectable after surgery or adjuvant therapy, it is strongly associated with a high risk of reoccurrence. The guidelines do state, though, that ctDNA is prognostic and not predictive in the adjuvant setting. One thing where I really see this playing a role is there's still a lot of debate if we should be using adjuvant chemo or observation in stage two setting. So ctDNA may have more of a role to assist in this decision in the future. So I'm really excited to see where this goes, and hopefully it will continue to provide more selective care for our patients. So either we make sure we're giving enough treatment or that we're also not over-treating these patients.
Yeah, and so considering there is a very complex web of treatment options for these patients, how do you approach these patients navigating colorectal cancer treatment? Do you have any advice for pharmacists and other healthcare professionals in the field?
Yeah, so when approaching these patients, throughout their journey of colorectal cancer. It's always important that we always are using compassionate support, but also clear and actionable information. So I always try to remember that when I am providing patient education and caregiver education when a patient is starting a new treatment. So, for example, I know we were talking about younger patients. So I make sure when I'm educating patients, specifically that are younger in age, one thing we talk about is safe sex practices, because we are giving these patients, sometimes cytotoxic treatment or hazardous treatment. And so if they are, sexually active with someone that is of childbearing potential, I make sure I take the time to go over that information with the patient. So, for example, making sure you use a barrier method, so the patient's partner is protected, and then also using two forms of birth control if they are having intercourse with someone that is of childbearing potential. I also make sure with these oral agents that we can use that the patient knows after they touch the pills, they need to be washing their hands really well so as not to spread maybe the risk of the contamination, like some of the residue from the pills, to someone else in the family. And then also with patients that have younger children at home, I make sure they know where to store these pills because they need to be storing it, room temperature, dry environment, usually away from any pets and children. So I make sure I stress, do not let children ever come into contact with these medications that can be very hazardous. Also, when thinking about children, because these younger patients usually, they're in the thick of life where they do have young kids running around. And a lot of times I have patients worry that they're going to put their child at risk for anything. And so I just try to ease those concerns and talk about really with children, a big risk is infection that can be given to the patient. So I try to put the patient at ease that they're not, putting their child at risk. Really, the risk is coming from the children putting the patient at risk of infection. So, we go over really good hand hygiene when the children get home from school, and, making sure the patient's protecting themselves the best way that they can. Also, when thinking about using, for example, the infusional 5-FU, where the patient actually takes home the medication, usually in a bulb that's attached to their port for 3 days. I just make sure patients know, how to bathe with this on and precautions to take when they're sleeping with having the bulb attached and looking for any leakage as well with that. Another thing I've noticed with younger patients when talking about this 5-FU bulb is making sure they know not to go in extreme temperatures for a long time. So, for example, I had a patient, a younger gentleman, who had a 5-FU bulb attached, and he decided to go fishing for a whole day the next day. So he spent 8 hours out in extreme heat, which caused the bulb to go in faster than what we would have liked. And so I just tell patients, of course you can go in and out in the weather, but just don't spend in a large amount of time out in extreme heat or cold while they have the bulb attached. I also make sure I provide calendars to all of our colorectal patients, and these are personalized calendars. So some of these regimens can be very complicated to know what to do when, especially at home or when coming in for labs or infusion appointments. So we do provide personalized calendars. Now, these are usually paper calendars that I give patients during education, but I have noticed with younger patients being diagnosed with colorectal cancer, they sometimes are more savvy and like to use their phone more. So we do talk about apps that you can download onto your phone that help manage all of your appointments, and then also setting alarms for when to take your anti-cancer agents at. I also think a pharmacist and other healthcare professionals can really play a role in mitigation of side effects from these. So this could include preventing certain side effects. So some examples that I now go over with patients is if they're receiving capecitabine, so the oral version of the fluoropyrimidine, we know hand-foot syndrome can be an issue with this. So based on the DTORCH study, we now recommend our patients to use diflucanac gel twice a day up front to prevent hand foot syndrome from the capecitabine. So I found that has been really helpful for our patients. The trick with this gel, though, is there are specific recommendations on how to use it. So I do take the time to go over that with our patients. So just some examples. When you get the gel, it does come with a dosing card. So I talk about how you lay the gel out on the dosing card and then put it on your hands and feet. Also, after applying the gel, patients have to wait 10 minutes before they cover their hands or feet, like with socks, for example. So we go over that in order to allow the gel to have time to absorb into the skin. And then we also talk about how they should not wash their hands or take a bath or shower for 1 hour after applying this gel. So that can really play a role into their normal day of life because now they're having to apply this twice a day. And so we just, I take the time to walk through their daily life and how they can fit this into their normal schedule in order to hopefully be more adherent with using these supportive measures. Another example is for regorafenib. We use the gradual dose escalation strategy now, and this was based on the phase two redose trial. So our patients are started out on a lower dose of regorafenib for cycle one, and then we increase it weekly by 40 milligrams to that max dose of 160 milligrams a day for subsequent cycles. This study really showed that patients are at an increased risk of making it through their cycles when you use this gradual dose escalation. So, for example, the primary endpoint was looking at the number of patients who make it to cycle three with regorafenib. And the patients that did the dose escalation group, 43% of those patients made it to cycle three. Whereas the patients that just started out already on the 160 milligrams a day dose, only 26% of patients made it to cycle three. So I think this just points out, making sure we're using any methods that we can to prevent toxicities because we're really trying to keep patients on these treatments for as long as possible so they have the most effect. And also, this improves patients' quality of life. Hand-foot syndrome can be very painful and irritating. So whatever we can do to prevent this is a positive thing for our patients.
Yeah, I think that's all really fascinating because there's always a lot of focus on treatment in, inside the clinic, but not necessarily treatment outside the clinic where most of it is happening, which is, in someone's home with the care of their family. Maybe that's who's taking care of them. Maybe an at-home nurse. Doesn't always happen within a clinic or a care setting. So all of those, tidbits about having making sure the children like wash their hands when they come in, or making sure that you wash your own hands after handling your medication. I think that those are things that I personally have never thought about. And in that case, I would say a lot of people also haven't. Really, I think that stresses the importance of your role as a pharmacist, the role of other pharmacists in colorectal cancer care and other cancers as well, in maintaining and ensuring that these patients really understand how these treatments work, making sure that they can then adhere to them. Because if they don't understand the treatment, it's going to make it much harder for them to stick with it. Thank you so much for joining me today. I don't know if you have any other thoughts that you'd like to share with our audience.
Pharmacists can play a role in making sure patients are getting their preventative screenings for colorectal cancer. So, if you are over the age of 45 years old, I recommend you do the appropriate screenings on a regular basis, according to the guidelines, because the CDC actually showed that 30% of the US population is not up to date on their colorectal screenings. That was a very surprising number to me. So just encouraging everyone to be up to date on their screenings. And then, for our younger patients, if you do ever have anyone complain of any of these symptoms we talked about. So, a change in their bowel habits, a change in appetite, weight loss, any bleeding or abdominal pain that can't be explained, really encourage these patients to talk to their doctors. So hopefully they can get, a colonoscopy or get screened as soon as possible just to rule out any cancer that could be there.
A big thank you to Megan for joining me on this episode to talk about colorectal cancer. And another big thank you to our audience for listening in. Stay tuned. We have a lot of exciting things coming up in the next couple of months. We're going to be talking about breast cancer and antibody drug conjugates, as well as squamous cell carcinoma and intratumoral immunotherapy. So stay tuned, and I'll see you in the next one.